Cornel West, do you teach Emerson? I mean, do your students read him?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They get him?
All the time.
I mean, in a sense,
well, none of us really
speak
get him. He's so elusive, but they do. We try to make sure that they see his depths, his insights, and the ways in which he's contemporary, the way in which he's relevant in the best sense of that word.
And what's the short form of that?
I think it has to do with the perennial kind of questioning, the way in which he keeps alive the legacy of a Socrates, the way in which he keeps alive the legacy of a Shakespeare, and the kind of questions and the way in which one wrestles with those questions are always relevant and contemporary if they're done right.
Yeah.
In our present context of materialism, narcissism, hedonism, imperialism.
All those are good things. Cornel West, who is Ralph Waldo Emerson to you?
Ralph Waldo Emerson, to me, is not simply the towering man of letters in American democratic experiment, but he's someone who specializes in keeping alive the Socratic energies in the culture, the themes of nonconformity, the themes of self-questioning, self-experimentation, self-exploration, self-interrogation. So that he is of use. I mean, he's someone who wants to be used. He's almost proto-pragmatic in that sense. Mm. I think he's a kind of American Hamlet, too, because he's actually, in my view, actually quite preoccupied with death and forms of death, facing mortality, the limits, the constraints of human experience. And in another way, he's a kind of American Isaiah in terms of American prophet, but second Isaiah, not so much first. This is the Isaiah that begins chapter 40 that talks about hope and talks about possibilities, not so much the prophet of doom, an indictment of American civilization. He's a prophet of possibility. And so it's a fascinating synthesis, really, a unique kind of combination to have that Socratic and the prophetic and the Shakespearean all fused together in Emerson.
But what's the self thing of the Socratic and definitely of the Emerson?
Well, it's the unexamined life is not worth living theme, in which for Emerson to be human is to unsettle that which is in place, to be suspicious of the dogmatic, to be nonconformist, as he would say, to be a self-reliant. He is self-preoccupied, but it's a self that has to do with an opening of that self such that that self connects with others and that self actually is involved in reflecting on the limits of one's own self.
Should we get hung up? Do you get hung up on Emerson's fixation on the self, the selfish side of the man? He didn't join Brook Farm after all. He was not a communitarian. He was not a joiner of anything. And he does teach us, in effect, you come in alone, you go out alone, look after yourself.
Mm-hmm. But I think Emerson, though, you know, like Chekhov and other great figures, he has a balanced conception of life. He knows that, on the one hand, we ought to die daily, in the language of Paul of the New Testament, but he also knows there has to be a self to die in order for that death to have significance, and that same self can be a resource to sustain oneself. Put it another way, that when Jesus says, love thy neighbor as thyself, well, you have to have loved thyself in order to really be able to genuinely love thy neighbor. And there has to be a self to love. But the process of loving the self includes a dying, but that dying is tied, of course, to a certain kind of rebirth. And so I think Emerson is always dynamic. He's always fluid. He's always flexible, improvisational, experimental. And there, so the self that he has in mind includes both poles. It's a pole of a certain kind of dying, and it's a pole of a certain kind of re-emerging, a certain kind of regeneration, as it were.
I think Emerson shows you a way to be full of self without being full of yourself.
Without being selfish.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Or self-obsessed.
Absolutely. So it's not as if the self disappears, as in, you know, the claims of a Schopenhauer. Who sees that self as a source of evil. No, Emerson knows that there's evil in that self, but he also knows that that self is full of possibility and potentiality. That's part of the balanced conception of life that you get in an Emerson or even a deeper level of Chekhov. So that it's that Shakespearean sense of trying to balance the various elements of the self that I think Emerson's preoccupied with. That's why when I call him an American Hamlet, you know, he's aware that the self's fundamental insecurities and incongruities and inconstancies and self-contradictions can never be solved in any broad sense. The question is, how do you cope with dignity, with grace, shot through with a certain moral conscience?
Hmm. Do you count him a modern?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, I think to be modern is to go back to Kant's 1784 essay of what is enlightenment. It is to seek release from one's self-incurred immaturity, to seek release from one's self-imposed tutelage, which is to say to dare to know, to have the courage to use one's intelligence to make oneself without having to fall back on some kind of external authority that answers it for one. And Emerson is Socratic to the core. He's a matter of daring to know and using his own critical intelligence to make and remake himself without looking to some authority outside of himself.
Hmm.
Even his notions of oversoul and various doctrines of correspondence, compensation, and so on, in the end, I think, have to do very much with a radical conception of a self that's suspicious of any authority external to that self. That's very modern, thoroughly modern. In some ways, it's even more modern than postmodern, in the sense that postmodernity is just a continuation of modernity by other means.
But I'm thinking, you know, is he a contemporary to you? Do you read him, as they say, for historical interest, or do you find he talks to this society and you?
You know, my good friend Jeff Stout, who's written a wonderful book, Democracy and Tradition, says that he could never read Emerson without leaving with a certain sense of joy as well as unsettlement. And I would say exactly the same thing. I think that Emerson, for me, is one of the most contemporary of 19th century figures, precisely because he speaks to the issues of life and death, of joy and sorrow, those perennial ones of mortality, history, reality, that just it resonates deeply. He's still a challenge. He's still an interlocutor in a very fundamental way.
How'd you come by him? When did you first read him? And what
I read him in high school, but I read him very seriously for my book, American Evasion of Philosophy. That was back in the summer of 86. I wrote the bulk of that book. It was published in 89. But
do the high school part and the professional part?
Well, high school was just a matter of sense of possibility. I mean, at that point, he was just the apostle of the American religion of possibility. The American religion of
self-reliance, probably.
It was a kind of vulgarized reading of Emerson in which, you know, we die every day and we're born to victory, that we can never be crushed, we always bounce back, that kind of Emerson. Tremendous stress on courage, confidence, valor, buoyancy, that has gone hand in hand with American religion of possibility. And that Emerson, of course, can be appropriated in a very vulgar way of just valorizing opportunity and downplaying the night side of things. The charge of Emerson has no sense of the tragic, no sense of the comic, and so on. And those were, those were textbook criticisms of Emerson. But when I actually had a chance to read through his corpus very, very closely, I could see that Emerson was much deeper and much more profound. You read essays like The Comic, The Poet, The Tragic, Experience, Fate. You cannot read those essays and walk away thinking that Emerson has no sense of the tragic and no understanding of darkness and despair.
Well, precisely. And I thought sometimes, I mean, he meets the modern definition of the blues man, if I may presume to say. I mean, he had a lot of death around him among his brothers. Mental illness, suffering, he lost his first wife, and yet there is such an affirmative kind of confrontation of the bad news in the classic blues fashion. Does that make any sense to you?
I think it does. I think that there is a sense, though, in which Emerson is aware of the darkness and despair and disillusionment, but he doesn't linger on it that long. This is where I think he's a little different than the blues man. I mean, if Chekhov is the blues man, then Emerson is a kind of on the way to becoming a Chekhovian, but not yet there. But he doesn't like to linger. Reminds me very much of Goethe, who has a deep sense of the darkness, but he doesn't want to linger long. He sees von Gleist, he sees those who have lingered, gone mad, lost their sense of balance. Emerson is much more closer, I think, to Goethe than he is to von Gleist. And in that sense, he has a wonderfully balanced sense of life, as Goethe does, but he's not as deep as a Shakespeare. There's no Lear or Hamlet in Goethe. Faust doesn't measure up to that. Emerson is a kind of American Hamlet in the sense that he knows that America has a night side it has to wrestle with, but he don't like to linger long on it either. I mean, even, you know, his responses to slavery and so forth, he was exemplary in terms of making various public pronouncements that Frederick Douglass liked, but he didn't stay there. He didn't linger there the way Douglass did. You see, he didn't want to have to get stuck in that darkness in the way that Douglass had the courage to get stuck and fought his way out. So there is a certain, to view Emerson as a blues man might be stretching it for me. I think he's on the blues.
But, no, I hear you exactly. I mean,
Melville is the real blues man, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And the Melville lingers, you see. I mean, for me, they go hand in hand. Those are the two great twins of 19th century Euro-American culture, the great Emerson and the inimitable Melville. I think in the end, Melville is more profound than Emerson, actually.
Well, Emerson lost his son and then wrote in the famous Experience essay, he said, "The only thing grief has taught me is to know how shallow it is." He didn't linger with it. He didn't sit with it.
No, it's true, and it's an understandable response, and it has its own kind of depth because grief can become, you know, an instance for self-pity, which is sentimental, and crocodile tears and so on. You're crying for yourself more than the person who's actually passed. But at the same time, I think that there is something about Emerson's text that always sides with the sense of joy, possibility, upbeat, even as he's so very aware of the downbeat aspects of life. No, but he is what he is, and I resonate deeply with so many parts of who he is. I would never want him to be anything different, because it's himself as a composite person that makes him the giant, the genius, the towering figure that he is. It's just that when he's viewed over against other towering figures, from, you know, Chekhov to Coltrane, from Melville to Toni Morrison or William Faulkner, that I think that in the end, though he is our greatest man of letters, and William James was a very close second, that when it comes to a profound conception of what it means to be human, that I would choose Melville or Faulkner or Morrison or Chekhov or Coltrane over him. He's still a little bit too distant from the blues sensibility that I view as the high mark of human maturity.
Hmm.
So it's an interesting conversation in terms of Rouse's depth and genius, and at the same time, in the end, his limitations and inadequacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think but some people hold it against him that he is a bit of a bubblehead. He's a cheerful, enthusiastic, oh, let's get on with it, onward and onward, as he says. And yet he does have that acquaintance with mental illness, with death.
And wrestle with, I mean, look at the deaths, you know. His mother passed early,
yeah.
Was it? His father passed, I forget exactly the age. He lost both brothers. He lost his wife. Ellen is 23. I mean, he lost major significant others by the time he's 38, including his five-year-old son. So there's no doubt that he was acquainted with the worst of what life had to offer in terms of those ugly deaths of loved ones. And yet the question is, what do you do with him? What he did with them? He didn't deny them, which is typically a sentimental gesture. He didn't kind of engage in a kind of pseudo-wrestling with them, which is melodramatic. But he actually had a real tragic sensibility. And the comic was underdeveloped, too, but it was there. There's no doubt about it.
There was a performance artist in there. I try to read those essays and imagine him kind of giving the talk on the road. I mean, he was a traveling show.
Oh, yes. He was the first great public intellectual to constitute a career as a lecturer on the circuit.
Yeah.
You know, in 1865, he lectured 70 times. You know, he's no spring chicken. I mean, he's an older man, and they didn't have American Airlines or United Airlines,
right.
You know. It's unbelievable. He had a passion to communicate that ought to inspire all of us.
Yeah, and people turned up, too.
They sure did.